Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. This week we have special guest Kevin Muir, live from Toronto, Canada, back on the show to help us answer the question, is the recovery driven by Robin Hood and robots? After a successful career as a derivative trader for the Royal Bank of Canada, Kevin foresaw the upcoming tech bust in the early 2000s and used this opportunity to jump out of corporate life and has been successfully running his own capital for the last 20 years. He details his thoughts on the markets and macroeconomic themes through his popular almost daily newsletter, The Macro Tourist. Kevin Muir, welcome back to Nicholas Investment Insights.
Great to be with you guys today.
Great to hear your voice. Very happy with that. And sitting across from me, of course, at a federally mandated distance, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Lovely. And just a quick reminder before we get started to subscribe on YouTube and click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch. And follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live right now, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar. So let's jump into it. So we've got a light agenda today just to sort of guide our conversation. We're going to kick off with some thoughts actually around yield curves and some new intro work from Kevin. But we'll also be talking about what creates a bubble, retail investors, switching asset classes, and then finishing off with lending as well. But before we jump into that, we do have a couple of late call charts from Kevin. And the first one today is talking about the Treasury curve and the first day of zero rates. Damien.
Yeah, so actually we might take one quick step back because I think we were just talking with Kevin before and I think he's got some very interesting points to make on, I guess, his view of where we're headed. And so I think it's probably been 6 months since we saw you last, Kevin, and we were talking at the time was obviously a very different world. And So I think one of the key things you were looking for there was the return of inflation and driven by central government spending. And obviously we've seen lots of central government spending. And I think that's probably where your thesis is coming. So we're sort of taking the view that, that there has been a big disconnection between fundamentals and the markets, and that a lot of this has been driven by sort of more technical issues. So I guess we're thinking it was an ordinary bounce that's then been pushed up by a mixture of robots and retail traders and a good mix of extra liquidity from the Fed sort of sloshing around that sort of pushed this further than it should. But you've got a slightly different take on this, and I'd love to hear to tell our listeners your take on it.
Well, no, I do agree with you that the Fed is pushing it up and that there is a lot of liquidity in the system that is kind of been fueling the rise. But one of the things that I do think is different this time in terms of this crisis versus the last crisis, which is if you recall back to the great financial crisis of 2008-09, at that time when the Fed cut rates to zero and then they went and did quantitative easing, we had all sorts of, pundits going around calling for hyperinflation and how this was going to be the death of the US dollar and all this sorts of stuff. And it actually got to the point where a bunch of really kind of famous kind of economists and other money managers wrote an open letter to Ben Bernanke in the Wall Street Journal telling him that the quantitative easing was threatening to cause inflation that was going to get out of hand. And I want to kind of highlight this because if you think back to that time, they lowered rates to zero, but the long end of the bond market responded by actually staying elevated, meaning that they actually, the difference, although the short end was zero, the kind of 30-year was trading at 1.5% or 2%. And so that's the first chart is that what I have there shows you kind of the yield curve of today. Or sorry, not today, the kind of the immediate cut to zero during the great financial crisis versus the corona crisis. And so you'll see that the blue line is the kind of great financial crisis yield curve. And you'll notice that it is really steep, meaning that the kind of as you went out, rates went up a lot.
And, now, and just to put this into context for the, just to put that into context for some of our listeners, you know, the central banks really control the short end of the curve, and it's more the market, certainly historically, that's more the market that's controlled the long end. So it's basically the market saying that they're expecting things to bounce back, to higher interest rates, and so you needed to be compensated if you're taking 30 years because there was going to be inflation at some stage in that 30 years, and so you needed to get a return for that. Sorry, Kevin.
Right, and this, no problem. And this is, so this is, if we think back to 2008, we had all these concerns about hyperinflation. The yield curve stayed really steep. This time, the yield curve flattened. So you'll see that this yield curve at the time when they cut rates was almost like a straight line across. It was stuck kind of lower. And then the next chart, which is basically the same curves 3 months out, which is today, you'll notice that although we have steepened a little, meaning that the orange line has kind of gotten a touch steeper, you'll notice that in the blue line, which is the great financial crisis, it's steepened way, way more. This is, again, because everyone was worried about hyperinflation and they were worried about this. They were rushing to buy gold. These QE programs were new, novel. People didn't understand them. So now let's contrast this to today, to the corona crisis. They go, the Fed cuts rates to zero, and everyone says, we've seen this before. There's never going to be any inflation, and I'm not going to worry about it, right? And this was the standard, kind of prevailing view. Think about to Scott Minard. You know, he runs $270 billion at Guggenheim. He starts talking about negative rates. He starts thinking the world's going to end. The last thing he is thinking is that this is going to cause hyperinflation. So he's not going to be signing the open letter to Jay Powell saying that this is going to cause hyperinflation. In fact, he's worried about the exact opposite of what everyone was worried about the previous time. So now, whenever I see the fact that all the hedgies going one way, I start to think, oh, geez, you know what? I better start thinking about going the other way because they've all positioned that way. Mm. And chances are that the market always surprises these guys.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I really believe is that this crisis is much different than the great financial crisis in that the fiscal response has been night and day. Now, we can talk about the monetary response and it has been extraordinary, and I agree with you that it has pushed up financial asset prices and done all that. But really what I'd like to focus on is on the fiscal side. So let's think back to 2008. We had some fiscal kind of responses in terms of cash for clunkers, and there was a couple other programs. But if you recall, very quickly, the Tea Party got in there with their sequestration, and they actually started demanding that the Treasury and the government balance the budget. They thought to themselves, listen, too much debt is what got us into this problem. Government has to stop spending.
And possibly there was a little bit of cynicism in terms of as well, Obama's the president, and if we can claim that, and even if we do believe that actually you do need to get in to support the economy, then a poorer economy might help an election. I guess in terms of
for sure, there are some that claim it was very Machiavellian in nature, and if you look at the Republicans, they seem to be fine with deficits when they're in power, and kind of complaining when they're not. But unless we get I'm not sure how many Americans are listening on this call, but it always seems that whenever we start talking politics, it's very divisive. So I always just try to kind of
go after the facts.
Yeah, yeah. We won't say anything about who whether this was on purpose or not.
That's
it
right.
just happened.
Yeah.
So I brought this chart, and what this chart is, if we could go to the U.S. federal budget, and this is the discretionary spending year over year change. And everyone thinks back, and when you ask someone about Obama and spending, they'll talk about how he made the debts all-time highs and how he spent so much money. And what they fail to realize often is that a lot of that debt was actually automatic stabilizers, meaning that when someone loses their job, they get the unemployment insurance or welfare goes up. And so those things, the government
taxes.
Can't control. Right. Exactly. Companies are going out of business. So there's less taxes coming in. So they're spending more and they're taking less in. And those things they can't control. But if we look at the things they can control, meaning their discretionary budget, and we look at the year over year real change, meaning like adjusted for inflation. And I created this chart back to 1961. And what it shows is that up until the great financial crisis, every year except three, that the federal budget deficit, or sorry, they spent more each and every year, meaning that they were spending more and more in real dollars each and every year, except for three. I think it was 1964, 1968, or 69, and then 1996. So I think one of them was Kennedy, or you know, or Johnson, when they were trying to have trouble with the Vietnam War, and there was that whole period. And then it was Clinton when he got in there, and he got Rubin convinced him to go and try to cut back on his spending so that he could get interest rates lower, and he thought that that would work. But you know, every other year it's gone up, and it's gone up by a lot. Like a lot of years, it was 8, 10, 12, 14%.
Yep.
So then we go. And so up until this point, the previous 4 decades, there's been only 3 years that total that the government spending has gone down. Then the great financial crisis comes. And for 5 years, it goes down. So the U.S. government was doing like pro-cyclical cuts. So like the private sector is having all this trouble dealing with the recession and all that. And so they're cutting back on spending. What does the U.S. government do? They go and they actually make it worse by also cutting. So that meant that the Bernanke was forced to do like take all the heavy lifting. It all fell onto his shoulders. And so we had kind of QE1, QE2, QE Operation Twist, QE3, which I think some people call QE Affinity. It was just, it kind of came down to so much monetary excess because the reality was that fiscal was making things worse. So now let's go and talk about since the Corona crisis. In 2008, when they had this problem, it was because of Wall Street and all these other banks that had spent too much money and nobody had any sorts of desire to help out, you know, the economy. And it was only after it became clear that they were going to pull down the whole economy that they actually started to do anything. Well, the Corona crisis was much different in that nobody was really to blame. And, you know, and least of all, it was the average person was going to actually be suffering from this. So it was easy for the government to justify spending money. So we see instead of this being similar to 2008, where the government wasn't spending any money, we are not only getting monetary stimulus, but we are getting unprecedented fiscal stimulus. You know, you see that the U.S. has spent 15.5% of GDP in fiscal stimulus. The EU is now on track to spend 30% of GDP. Japan is spending a record 40%. The U.K. is a little lower, 5%. China's 8.5%. I looked you guys up in Australia. You guys are running around 7-ish from what I can see. But yep. It's much, much different in that there is a fiscal stimulus kind of reaction. And okay. What this has done is, do you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I've got a few questions about the whole, because I guess where it's coming from. So there's obviously a bigger hole on the other side. So this is one side of it, which is the government side. We've got the corporate side then as well. And so we can see, let's say we're looking at this chart in broad pictures. So most of the 70s, we did have a big inflation problem, and you can see, you know, high government spending and big inflation problem. And then the next sort of bit, that 2000s, where there's a little bit of an inflation problem, but and raising rates, but the rates never really got that high, and the government spending was quite high. And on the flip side, though, over that period, the amount of private borrowing was dramatically increasing as well. So you sort of
that's
had,
correct.
So you sort of had this double whammy of not only the government spending but also the private spending. And inflation, while it did go up in that sort of 2000 period, it didn't really get out of control. And then you go to the financial crisis and you go, yes, we've had government pulling back, but we have had corporates over the last few years really ramping up. So they're sort of, while you got on one side the government stepping back, corporates were ramping up, not at the start, but certainly in later periods. So now we're sort of sitting at record corporate debt. I guess what I'm sort of taking this next step and saying, well, now corporates are, where they're increasing debt, it's not because they want to, it's because they have to, because they've got negative cash flows. Nobody's sort of borrowing to go and build new factories and all that part. So at a certain, and we're sitting there with unemployment jumped whatever, what, 7 or 8% in the US over that in the 2000s, whereas now we're talking about jumping more like sort of double that. So I guess the hole is a lot bigger that the government has to fill. So do you have a sort of feel on the difference in the, you know,
So I completely agree with everything. The one pushback I will have say about your corporate debt argument is that I don't think corporate debt actually went into CapEx. I think it went into mostly buybacks. Mm. It was a lot of financial engineering. And it didn't actually go into the real economy.
Yeah, but in a way, I mean, I guess I look at buybacks and say, okay, well, I don't know. It's a sort of view about where I look at a company and say, okay, if you're sort of looking at your balance sheet and saying, we wish we had some more debt, do you go and make a $1 billion acquisition that might just destroy value? Or do you just go back and buy $1 billion worth of stock? If you'd already made the decision to actually go and do that,
it's a sort of, bonus.
Yeah, that's right. You want to leverage up. I don't really care which way you're doing it.
Neither one of those are hiring new people or building new factories.
No, but they are giving money to other people who own the stock, and in theory, hopefully, some of those will eventually. I suppose that's a trickle down theory, isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm not disagreeing with kind of we're just arguing about little things.
Yeah.
No doubt, there is a huge hole to fill. Hmm. So I will not deny that. And when you sit there and we talk about a certain amount of the U.S. spending 15% of GDP. Do we really know if that hole is big enough? Like, I mean, is that filling the hole, or do we need 20% or 25%? Mm. Because as you say, the unemployment's huge. There's lots of companies going bankrupt. I don't know what the actual number is, but I will tell you this. I think that there's been a huge change in how people view spending by governments. And that, I think, is the part that is kind of the switch is being clicked. And I don't think it's kind of I do think it's kind of ironic that Stephanie Kelton's book, The Deficit Myth, has come out right in this period.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I believe is that we have always been I truly believe that the governments are not ever financially constrained. They're always real resource constrained. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? I think that a government like Australia, like Canada, US, they can go and they can always create dollars to pay off their borrowing. So therefore, you kind of say to you, once you think that through, you go, well, that doesn't make sense. If a government creates, too many dollars, then that's going to make the dollar worth less, which point I completely agree. That's when you run into inflation. And that is the real constraint. And, that is what holds back real, countries. And up until now, we've had a situation where we had very little inflation. And I would argue that we've been kind of tricking ourselves into thinking that we are financially constrained. And so we went, and let's take Europe, because I think Europe's the best example. Europe is going and their economy is suffering. And, we'll talk before the corona crisis, their policies before the corona crisis, and their economy is suffering and they're having high unemployment. And how do they kind of address that? They address that by trying to lower interest rates, to negative and even more negative in the hopes that somebody somewhere borrows and spends.
Yep. I'd probably say that what they're hoping, it's worth noting as well that it's a very diverse economy in that a lot of the unemployment was in some states, whereas Netherlands, Germany, a few of the northern states actually had quite low rates of unemployment. So it was was bad, but it's actually a very diverse sort of patchwork.
Yeah. For sure, but there's no doubt that they're trying to fix their problems with monetary, through monetary means instead of, fiscal means. And I've always said, if I was the benevolent dictator of Europe, I would immediately raise rates from their negative, 50 basis points to 100 basis points, and I would cut taxes and do infrastructure spending until the economy balanced.
I'll vote for that policy. So.
Yeah, all right.
when you run for benevolent dictator, let me know.
And so one of the things that I think that we've kind of mistakenly thought is that over the past four decades, there's two ways you can make money. The private sector can make money through bank lending, and the government can create money by spending. And we've kind of every single recession have tried to fix it through monetary means. So we get a recession, we lower rates, hoping that that private sector and people will be encouraged to borrow more and spend and get out of it. And so if you look, each and every kind of peak in interest rates has been lower and lower and lower because we keep adding more and more debt because we keep trying to do it solely through the monetary means. And this is like for those kind of bears out there who foresee this debt imploding in on us. I completely agree that if the government refuses to go and create money, that this would be our fate. If we try, I think Europe is a perfect example.
Yes.
Europe continually just tried to do it with lower and lower interest rates, and it didn't work. And you actually hit a point where you lower interest rates to a level where it becomes counterproductive. And I don't know where it is, but I'm pretty sure Europe's already there. That's all I know for sure.
Yeah, that's right. And we sort of argue that point with the bank. You know, you got two problems there. One is he's getting to that negative rate, but you end up with the banks. The yield curves are so flat that the banks don't want to lend to people, and then you get stuck in that. Your rates are so low that people, you know. And in the end, no he sits there and goes, oh, I can lend at, you know, 1.5%, and now I can lend at 1.25%. Oh, let me go and double my CapEx expenditure plans.
Right, sort of like, you nailed it right there, because if you think about it, I think the Deutsche Bank CEO got in there and he says, listen, you go and you lower interest rates, it's not going to encourage any of my clients to go out and, you know, build a new factory. And it's funny because Goldman Sachs actually did a study and they looked at the kind of relationship of CapEx to interest rates. And in the 80s and 90s, it was negatively correlated, meaning that as interest rates went down, the CapEx spending went up, which made sense, you know, right? But then in 2000s and 2010s, it actually became positively correlated, which means that as interest rates went lower, people were less inclined to go make a factory. And it kind of, if you think about it intuitively, it makes sense, because if you're sitting there and you're the CFO deciding whether to make this factory or not, it doesn't really matter if it's, you know, 100 basis points or 50 basis points. The real worry is nobody buys your product. Yes. And instead of your asset being worth 100 cents on the dollar, it ends up being worth 50 cents on the dollar. And so as interest rates go lower, it becomes people are less inclined to actually go do CapEx spending.
And that actually comes back to my next issues, because I think, and I should frame as well just for listeners, like I think Kevin's on the money for this change in attitude. Like, I just remember that first in the financial crisis, and I think they were trying to do, I think it's feel like a $700 or $800 billion they had to pass the house in the US, and they knocked it back the first time, and markets had this huge tantrum, and then
the debt ceiling
This was sort of the financial crisis. Okay.
It was the first TARP. I think it was the first TARP.
And then the markets had this massive tantrum, and then they sent it back, and they said, okay, well, maybe we got that wrong and put it through. And this time it's like, oh, there's $1 trillion. Oh, we need another trillion? Yeah, no worries. Oh, one more? Yeah, toss it on the pile.
they're falling all over each other to do it.
Yeah.
They're competing amongst the two parties who can spend more.
Exactly. So I think you're right there. The question for me is, and I think I described it before, is the wheels are spinning though. So in terms of getting this inflation, the wheels are spinning. When does it actually get traction? And then you take off, because you're right. You know the amounts that are being spent are massive. But I guess I've got these two worries. One is that's what I spoke about how big the hole is and when that hole actually gets filled. The second one is coming back to, you know, inflation. In my mind, has sort of two main elements to it. You've effectively got too many people chasing too few goods with too much money, and so there's two sides to it. One is if you've got lots and lots of supply out there and lots of spare capacity, then when people come out and say, "Oh, I need more of whatever it is," then suppliers just go, "Oh, great, here you go. I'm operating my factory at 50%. Now I can move it to 55% and work my way up." So there's that side, and then the other side's the demand side, is that if people aren't actually, as you said, people aren't actually wanting to buy the products, then you know, it doesn't matter what you build, and so that sort of caps your you can't put your price, if nobody wants to buy your product at $100, then putting your price up to $110 isn't gonna create more people buying it. So I guess that's where I'm sort of looking at the supply side right now and saying, well, the supply side seems like we've actually got heaps of extra capacity. And so we've sort of got to work through, and a lot of that will come offline, okay, but we'll work through that before we get some inflation.
So the other thing I think that from a secular longer term perspective, if we think about kind of the two main disinflationary themes of the past couple of decades, which is one of the labor kind of supply coming on board, meaning that when the Berlin Wall or when the Iron Curtain fell and, you know, all those countries joined, there was a huge amount of labor. And then that shortly thereafter with China joining the WTO. So I think for the past kind of, you know, 20 years, labor has definitely been in the backseat and capital has been driving the car because there's been tons of labor. So globalization from that perspective has caused both inflation to be lower and interest rates to be lower.
Yep.
Now, if we think about what's happened because of, I would argue we were already on this track with Trump and other leaders finally getting fed up with China, but at the very least, the COVID has no doubt changed the whole dynamics about the supply chains.
Yep.
And I would argue that globalization is going in reverse. And so if in the past it caused disinflation and lower interest rates, I would argue it very likely will cause inflation and higher interest rates, especially if the governments are willing to monetize it with fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus.
Yeah, so, well, and I guess working at that same time, and I think you're absolutely right in terms of the reversal of globalization. And with the two, on the flip side of that, we've got a lot more automation, and I think a lot of the supply chains that are coming back will be, you know, I can't afford to pay somebody whatever, $10,000 a year or whatever I'd pay somebody in China to do this, because, you know, my minimum is I have to pay them $60,000 or $70,000 in the US or Canada or Australia or whatever. And so I'll just stick robots in to do it and automate it. And so there'll be sort of this initial, yeah, so, and at the meantime, China's trying to sell stuff even cheaper because they've got all this extra supply over there. And so I guess I'm just not sure how that competing force, I think, whether the automation part is going to dampen down as well, and especially, you know,
I understand your argument that there is like a supply glut out there that's just waiting, you know, there's lots of supply waiting, but I really feel that the attitude amongst governments, and going back to what you said about the governments just being willing to spend, and it's not just the governments on terms of the spending, don't forget, it's also on the monetary side. We haven't even talked about this, and I guess we should get to this because this is going to be part of your worry about the stock market with all the robo advisors and then all this new Robin Hood coming around. But the fiscal kind of side of it, in 2008, the Fed's balance sheet was $1 trillion. It took 5 years for them to get to $4 trillion. 5 years, okay? In 2020, when the corona crisis hit, I think they had done it within 5 weeks.
Yep.
Sat there and I watched. My joke is that I'm on this. I signed up for the Federal Reserve's email that kind of just announces what they bought that day. So kind of the recap, and it goes through. And it was coming so often, I felt like they were spamming me that there was something wrong. And I would get this email, and I was just completely just flabbergasted because they would go through what they had bought. And it would be like, this TIPS issue, they bought $300 million. This government bond issue, $250 million. And the numbers were just, until you saw it, you just couldn't really get your head wrapped around it. Mm-hmm. They literally took the balance sheet from $4 trillion to $7 trillion in a couple of months. And people don't appreciate how dramatic that was. And this is, again, back to my kind of argument that governments have changed their attitudes dramatically. And if we go back to 2008, they were worried about Bernanke. They didn't want him doing this. Lots of people were telling him he's wrong. This time it was like, nope, let's go. Let's do whatever it takes. You know, markets are down. Do more.
Yeah.
You know, this bond's having trouble. And it just, this is why I think that it might surprise us on both the inflation point of view and also the market's point of view that these things can go farther than we think because the government has just gone crazy. Yeah. And it used to be don't fight the Fed. I kind of think it's like don't fight the Fed and don't fight the fiscal now. Like there's two of them. There's like, you know, it's not just one. It's not just one kind of pushing against us.
Yeah. So in terms of the dollar amounts, and I guess this is a good example of trying to work out how big the hole is. And I guess what I'm wondering is, so just in broad sense, I think the US deficit is sort of 24 odd trillion, and they're looking to add about another 4 trillion over the year. So you'll end up with about 28. And so I guess what I'm wondering is whether the Fed's front-loaded this. Have they front-loaded it? And so they've been out buying all these bonds sort of before the government's had to spend it, because the government's put in a lot of these promises about what they're going to spend, but really they're not getting the tax revenue that's coming, that came in for the first, say, for between March and June, was the tax revenue that was incurred in the January to March sort of period. So that they didn't really see a tax revenue hit, and so they'll really start seeing the tax revenue hit over the next few months, and so the actual issuance of government bonds is going to have to really lift. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, let's say the government have only increased their debt by $1.5 trillion over the last couple of months, and in the meantime the Fed's gone and bought another $3 trillion worth of bonds. So they've overwhelmed it, and that sort of that other $1.5 trillion then sloshes around. Is that,
yeah,
we're going into this next period will they keep filling?
But if you look, there's something called the Treasury General Account, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's basically like a checking account for the Treasury. And in the old days, before the great financial crisis and before interest on excess reserves, it was always like the government wouldn't run a balance. And it has to do with the kind of monetary policy and why they couldn't. And then what happened was that once they did interest rates on excess reserves, they were able to actually run a kind of a checking account, meaning that the government could go out and pre-fund stuff. And Obama was the first to do this. So Obama went, and when he got into trouble on one of the budgets, he decided, whoa, I better go and kind of issue bonds ahead of time because, you know, if the government shuts down, I'm going to need that money. And so he ran up the Treasury General account. And then what happened was he didn't need it, and then they ran it back down. And you'll see that this actually affects the stock market. As they're running it up, it actually causes stock market to be weak, and then as they're running it down, it causes the stock market to be positive. Yeah. And I think that's just because the money's going out into the economy. Well, to your point, they've actually run the Treasury General Account. It used to be the highest, I think, was $80 billion. They now have a $1.5 trillion balance, meaning that they've gone and borrowed $1.5 trillion.
Yep.
That has yet to be spent.
At the same time, hasn't the central banks, as you said, have just bought $3 trillion worth of extra bonds? So
right, but could we agree though that is just a monetary operation and is probably not going to affect the real economy? Although it might affect financial prices. The QE probably doesn't really affect the real economy because it doesn't change people's behavior in terms of borrowing money. It doesn't change people's CapEx, you know, decisions. It doesn't actually do anything. It does very little to the real economy.
At low interest rates, where we are today. I agree. Right. But I guess what I'm saying is the trillion they've bought has been from somebody who then goes and puts that money somewhere else, and it probably ends up...
I completely agree with you there. And I think I am 100% on board with you that they have caused a stock market bubble.
Yes.
And I will not dispute that. And if, you know what, why don't we, what you want to transition to that and start talking about that? Cause it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like, I think, and those that are listening to me, I have to explain that I do kind of mix my time frames sometime. And so one of the things when I'm talking about the long time frame, I think that there is a good chance that we are going to surprise and continue to surprise on the upside with the stock market and inflation. And I really think that when I'm thinking about worries for my portfolio, I'm more worried about inflation and I'm more worried about bonds than anything else. Bonds were always viewed as the ballast that, you know, saved your portfolio. I think they're eventually going to be the anchor that drags down your portfolio. Mm-hmm. But that's longer term. Shorter term, I'm 100% in your camp that this stock market has gotten bubbly. I see this Dave Portnoy guy who's entertaining as heck. But you know what? When someone's getting on TV and getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of people watching him, and he's telling you the stocks only go up, your antenna has to go on, and you have to be starting to worry about that from a trading perspective that we are due for a correction.
Yeah. Mm. And that's you know, some of the stats we've been trotting out is sort of we think there's been about 9 million odd trading accounts across all these different, like Robinhood alone's had 3 million in the first quarter. We think there's been about 9 million odd across the whole market. And so it's a little bit apples with oranges, but during the just in terms of total number of trading accounts in the US, I think there's about post the tech boom, they hit about 19 million per household, which doesn't count for double accounts. But and then it fell back to 17 million, and it's basically been 17 million for the last, you know, 20 years. And so it's a real increase. Like, you know, if you look at the amount of extra trading that happened in the tech boom because of retail accounts, you know, this is real increase. And it appears to us that a lot of that's all ended up in derivatives that then sort of helps push the market even more. So, you know, you might only invested 5,000, but if you've done that in a CFD or you know, a call option with an out of the money call option, you might have actually caused, you know, $10,000, $15,000 worth of actually hedging. Yeah.
For sure. I think that Luke Kawa from Bloomberg wrote a piece, and it was actually interesting. He wrote it before the corona crisis about this part of the internet, this Reddit group. It was called Wall Street Bets. And they would actually go and do bull raids on companies. They would go and they figured out that if they got the market maker short all sorts of gamma on their option book, they could then push it and it would become a self-fulfilling kind of prophecy, pushing it higher. And so they were kind of responsible for, you know, originally lifting Tesla, and then they went after space like that Virgin Galactic, and they think they went after Lumber Liquidators. And it was just what, there was this moment where he wrote the article and it was getting really frothy and crazy, and then the COVID struck and all of a sudden everyone forgot about it, and now on the way back up, these guys have come back with a vengeance, because now not only are they sitting there with nothing to do, but they also have all these stimulus checks in their jeans. Because like a lot of these young people are actually making more money not working than they ever made. And there's no doubt about it, they are pushing some crazy stuff, and there is just the absurdity of like Hertz going up, and which is a bankrupt, you know, it's like the new business model is to take your company bankrupt because it'll cause your stock to go up. And it
sounds sustainable.
It's just crazy. And, you know, and to your point, I thought, you know, we remember they started speculating on the USO, meaning the oil ETF. When oil went way down there, they all came for the oil ETF. They pushed that to a huge premium, to the point where they couldn't issue enough shares. They actually ran out of shares. There was 1 billion shares that they, when someone had making the original prospectus, they said, I could just see it. They're like, well, how many shares should we authorize? The guy goes, put in 1 billion, then we're never going to need more than 1 billion. And then sure enough, they needed more than 1 billion and they couldn't get the shares, right? They had to file another prospectus. Right. So there's no doubt about it. These young people, they're speculating and it's going crazy, and it's feeling very much like 99.
Mm-hmm. And so that's because I was trying to get a feel for how much longer this can go. And that's my take is going, well, I sort of look at two analogies I'm sort of been considering. One is the 99, where you said, okay, well, and that sort of ran for at least a year, probably 18 months of really frothy, where, you know, and that had a, you know, the grain of truth behind that was obviously the internet's going to change the world, and people would look at these companies and, yeah, it's losing money now, but it's going to make a lot, and look how much they're getting per subscriber, and they're growing subscribers. And so there's sort of a reason behind that. And it's a similar one today, I guess. It's just gone the other way in terms of going, well, this stock used to be worth $3, and although their profits are down 90% or now they're negative or whatever, you know, one day they could get back, is the argument. There's one side of it to that.
What's interesting though about 99 is about the internet is that it did change the world.
Oh, absolutely.
And there were some great companies that came out of that. Mm. You know, Amazon's a perfect example, but Amazon went on to be the world's largest company, but at its peak in the 2000 bubble, it then proceeded to get cut by 90%.
and Cisco, which is a great company, we, you know, I think don't think it's ever made it back to its the highest or whatever. The one I always bring out is because you know everyone knew about the internet. The search was this great thing and it was going to be fantastic, and people were buying Lycos and Yahoo and Excite and AltaVista and all these companies. You know, a lot of our listeners would have never heard of, but. You know, and then everyone goes, well, Google was the one that won it. Yeah, well, Google wasn't even listed. Didn't even list until like 3 or 4 years later. So people were sort of right in a way that they were like, yeah, one of these guys is going to be fantastic. But paying 300 times or 400 times for, you know, Excite.
Pets.com.
Or he's sort of like was going, well, it would have been rational if you had got Google, but because you weren't the winner, you sort of lost it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so
there's that famous one from Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems. And here, I'll just read it. I just pulled it up. He says at 10 times revenue. So he talked about like the valuation of Sun Microsystems. He says at 10 times revenue, to give a 10-year payback, I'd have to pay you 100% of our revenues for 10 years straight in dividends. Yes. That assumes I can get that to buy my shareholders. That assumes I have zero cost of goods sold, which is very hard for a computer company. That assumes zero expenses, which is really hard with 39,000 employees. That assumes I pay no taxes, which is very hard. And that assumes you pay no taxes on your dividend, which is kind of illegal. And that assumes with zero R&D for the next 10 years, I can maintain the current revenue run rate. Now, having done that, would you like to buy any of my stock at $64? Do you realize how ridiculous those basic assumptions are? You don't need any transparency. You don't need any footnotes. What were you thinking?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the nature of a bubble.
So that's one, and that ran for a while, because I guess there was a lot of, there's as you said, there was a lot of truth behind that. And it was just a matter about saying, well, the truth got over extrapolated or brought forward way too early. And so there's that part. And then another probably more apt example is, or at least at the other end of the extreme, is the Chinese 2015 bubble, where the Chinese government basically came out and said, you know, we want everyone to buy stocks and we're going to help get margin lending and, you know, all that type of stuff. And up went the stock market by 60-70%. And then all of a sudden they then decided, well, maybe that isn't such a good thing to have a massive stock market bubble and we wouldn't stand behind everything. And so that sort of only ran for sort of 6 or 8 months before, I think, well, you know, pick your levels. I suppose if you pick the level of to where it reached afterwards, sort of 3 or 4 years later, you'd sort of say it probably had 3 months up and 5 months down. And I guess that's where I'm going. Well, are we closer to a? Do you think we're closer to a? Let's say there is a big profit hole that doesn't come back for years now. Do you think we're closer to a to an internet side where the market can live with it for 18 months before the gravity takes hold, or do you think it's more like a Chinese stock market type boom where it's a up and down in a few months' time, and then sort of economic reality takes over again?
So I think that the response from the governments is going to dictate how long the bubble goes and how it's going to eventually end. And so if we get a return of fiscal prudence and people decide that they want to try to balance the budget and that, you know, they think to themselves, this is what we're leaving our grandchildren, and they believe the governments can't create money, then I think you're going to get Europe. We're going to get, it'll roll over very quickly, and then we'll
Europe
have
would be a good case.
Decades.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, decades outside, decades of stock markets going nowhere. And having said that, if the opposite happens, meaning that if we go and they decide, look, you know, we can print money without worrying about this, there is no kind of consequence to this, so why wouldn't we continue to spend?
Yeah.
I think that it would surprise people to the upside, and that it will only be when the bond market finally revolts and that they will be the ones to take the keys away from the Fed, and it won't be the government, it won't be the stock market. So in that environment, I think it could go a lot higher than anyone thinks, because I think you'll be getting 5% inflation, real rates will be firmly negative, and I could see a situation where they leave the front end at 100 basis points. The inflation's running 500 basis points and the long end is trading, you know, 800 basis points. But the stock market is screaming because, you know, the short end, there's nowhere, it's negative. The financial repression is just killing you.
Okay, but
so I'm probably not as bearish as you guys.
But where's
way.
The, I guess I'm trying to work out where the time frame is, because I don't have a problem with that as a longer term view, but I guess where I'm trying to work out is you need to get out of these holes. You got to get that out of that supply hole. You got to get out of this demand side hole as well. And to me, we're talking years before we can sort of get traction.
But were you surprised at how much the stock market rallied?
Yes, I was.
Okay, were you surprised at how well some economic numbers bounced?
No, I haven't been. I think I'd say in terms of the economics, because I guess what I'm looking at is I've sort of baselined where we were beforehand, and they're trying to work out where we're going to get back to. Within a certain range, because I think the percentage numbers are crazy in either way, because it's that part about going, well, if it just fell by 80%,
then it can fall so rise by 100%, and
so it falls from 100 down to 20, so you fall on 80%, then you can double, you can go from 100 to 20 up to 40, and you're still down 60%, but the 100 sounds really good. It's like check out that we just doubled
I think, though, there's a lot of things that on the economic side that are surprising a lot of people.
Right.
Like housing, for example. Toll Brothers said that they had never had as many deposits. It's since 2005 since they've had as many deposits on their houses.
Yeah.
I think if you go talk to people that are trying to buy things like boats, like you wouldn't think anyone's buying a boat, but they're going crazy. And I think that there's a lot of... I think the government has done a surprising job filling the hole. Mm. And I think there's a lot of money in people's jeans. And that's why a lot of these, you know, stocks are going crazy. But I think that when the economy reopens fully and they're able to spend, I think you're going to find that the economy surprises to the upside.
Yeah.
And assuming we don't get a kind of real problem with the second wave, which very well could be. And that's probably why I am bearish over the short run.
Yep.
But I just think at the end of the day, if a government is willing and able to create to spend and do whatever it takes, and just think back to Jay Powell, what he said. Jay Powell told Pelosi to think big and to spend more, to do more.
Yep.
And that's such a difference in changing. And so everyone always says to me, but where is the inflation going to come from? They say, oh, well, there's all the supply, or there's all the demographics. And I go, if you push enough into it, like if you put enough money in everyone's jeans, it will turn into inflation. It will do it. And the reason that it didn't turn into inflation last time is because it didn't go into the real economy. Mm-hmm. QE is not inflationary, but yet fiscal spending is inflationary. Eventually the government will spend and do stuff. Like we're already talking about doing infrastructure, all these sorts of things. I think you're going to find that the government starts competing for real resources and that they cause inflation. And whether you get, as the economy is opening back up, we get a kind of a one whoosh lower in terms of deflation or disinflation, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. And I'm not smart enough to say that we're only going up from here. But to me, it really feels like the government's attitude towards this is all changed. And to me, the big point is the surprises, I think, will be to the upside. Just like the stock market surprise was to the upside, I think the inflation numbers surprises will be to the upside.
Kevin, just a quick question, actually, and I'll throw out to anyone listening in as well to head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar to pop in your own questions. When you're talking about inflation, so what you're saying is that, like, so at the domestic level inflation, i.e., a dollar for, or is it a loonie for a can of Coke, is going to be affected just as much as asset price inflation, i.e., you know, paying 60 times now for stocks rather than 30 times. And you honestly think obviously asset price inflation is obvious because it's just going to pour into the financial markets as it has been. But you honestly think that, so you think that the domestic inflation piece is going to be pulled up as well? Is that sort of what you're saying? Yeah. So driven by wage growth or driven by...
Oh, I think we are going to get wage growth. Like, for example, you know, I thought it was kind of ironic that before the corona crisis that Trump was bragging about the fact that... never have the lower end done so well in terms of had such increases in the amount of wages, right? Mm-hmm. And what he kind of failed to mention is that something like 26 of the states had instituted their own dramatic increases in minimum wage.
Yeah.
And this goes back to my feeling that for the past 40 years, we've had kind of capital over labor because we've had this labor supply, you know, glut. And it was like, you know, the moment somebody asked for a raise, they went and they said, okay, well, we'll just move it to China. And I really do truly believe that this is turned, and that we are going to see labor inflation.
And I'm with you on that, but I still think we need to eat through our 20% unemployment first. That's the issue. And I don't know how long that's going to take.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm not disagreeing. And like, well, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe we have there's 6 months to a year of disinflation while we get through all this. And all I know though is that the hedgies and all the money managers, they all believe that disinflation or even deflation is a problem. And there's very few people who believe that inflation is a problem. And that's why I think from a risk reward perspective, things like buying, you know, inflation break evens, which is a trade I love, is really attractively priced, or even the steepener. Like that's another trade in terms of buying the short end and short and going short the long end.
I'm going to rewind back.
I know those
second.
Are kind of sophisticated trades.
Yeah, I'm going to rewind back a second because I'm interested in some of the thing you're talking about, people having money in their pocket, and it's the sort of like it's a real disconnect between you saying, okay, we've got 20% unemployment, but there's all these people with money in their pocket, and I do believe it's true because it's that part about the people who are most likely to lose their job were actually the blue collar workers and the lower paid, and a lot of the better paid workers have managed to keep on their job, which is where your part, right. And that the part is what you're saying about some of these houses or higher end places have actually got more people buying because that inequality means that, you know, the lower price people weren't going to buy the house anyway. Is that where you're seeing as well from your perspective?
I think it's everyone, because I'll tell you, if you go look at one of the big Republicans, one of those, the deficit hawks, one of their big pushbacks is that nobody wants to go back to work because they were actually making more than minimum wage being unemployed.
And that just sounds like a minimum wage problem though, doesn't it?
it does. And I completely agree with you. I don't disagree at all. And I guess if I was a benevolent dictator, I'd raise minimum wage and I would monetize it through the government.
Yeah.
And I know that flies, you know, in contrary to what a lot of economists think, but I disagree completely. And I think that if you go look at minimum wage in real terms, it's kind of at the all-time lows kind of 2-3 years ago, and it's due to go the other way. And I think this is the start of a new trend. So now, in terms of who has the money, you're right. There's no doubt that the rich have probably continued to do better. Let's face it, who owns the stocks? It's the rich people. I do think it's kind of ironic and funny that it's been the older generation that have been kind of lamenting the rise and warning about it. And meanwhile, this younger group, this Dave Portnoy and the millennials are charging ahead. And to some extent, it makes sense because if you think about it, like, you know, he was making fun of Warren Buffett, which I thought was kind of funny because a lot of people got all offended by it. But he's like, Warren Buffett's 89 years old. He should go home and have a nap. And it was kind of rude, but it's kind of funny at the same time. And it's like the guy's a marketing genius. But if you think about it, you know, this Dave Portnoy guy, he's like 35 years old or whatever. He has nothing to be afraid of with the virus. He gets it. Chances are he's just going to be sick and he's going to be fine in 2 weeks, right? Warren Buffett gets it and it's potentially life ending. So it makes sense to some extent that this might be a changing of the guard. And I was kind of laughing because I'm a Gen X. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah,
and I was
I'm with you, but the other guys here.
We're the mopiest generation around. We don't do anything. We just sit around and watch the boomers and the millennials do it. But I really watched as this has gone on. And as these millennials have kind of grabbed hold of it, the boomers are all sitting there saying, no, you guys don't know what you're doing. You're going to lose so much money. This will end badly. And the millennials are kind of just charging ahead. And what happens if they also charge head on the politics side and we get full-blown MMT all throughout the world?
Oh, look, yeah, but we're a few years away from that yet. And I guess, and given you're part of the Gen X as well, you would have seen all your friends in the tech boom, I'm assuming, would have been sort of, you know, at the same thing.
Right.
You know, all sort of mid-20s and just going, hey, this is the greatest thing ever. I bought this stock I've never heard of that, you know, has got a .com on the end and it just went up 100%. And so I've got to throw everything into the market. And so...
For sure. Listen, yeah. I just think that... Don't forget, it was pretty crazy. Like, I remember I was sitting on the institutional equity desk in the late 90s, and I remember thinking in 99, kind of like that kind of fall when it started taking off, that it was really crazy. And then the NASDAQ proceeded to double from there.
Yeah.
Double. Like, it doubled in what, like, you know, in 3 months. And people also forget that, you know, a lot of people kind of gloss over this, but one of the reasons that kind of final 3 months was so violent was because Greenspan went, and he was all worried about the problems from the Y2K bubble. And he shoved a ton of liquidity into the system over the kind of that Y2K period. And that kind of fueled that final violent rally. And when you go look now at the Fed's balance sheet and you look at that little Y2K blip, it's quite amusing because it's so tiny. It felt so big at the time, but it's so tiny. But yeah. I really think that those kind of policies drove the speculative kind of, you know, like energy. And it wouldn't take much for this to just keep going. I keep saying this, but let's talk about the other reasons why it might go down over the short run. And we haven't really touched on any of these. One, it's quarter end. And just like in the March quarter end, when all the pension funds were forced to rebalance and there was going to be a huge buying of equities and a selling of bonds, we're now faced with the opposite, because we've had stocks like stock market. The S&P is 48% off the low. NASDAQ's 52%. I looked, your market is up 41%. So pension funds that try to keep kind of an equal weight in terms of allocations to stocks and bonds, they're going to be forced to be selling. That's the first thing. Second of all, we have like the Russell rebalance coming up. Oftentimes when you get these sorts of rebalances, the higher kind of capitalized stocks go in and then lower stocks, capitalized stocks come out. A lot of times they have to sell, the indexers have to sell to get that in, to get that done. We have kind of speculation gone amok with everyone being long. And I would say that even some of the big kind of public bears are throwing in the towel. So for the first time, it feels to me like it's, guys are scared to be short. Well,
that was one of the charts from that Bank of America Merrill Lynch one that came out, where basically the fund managers are like, this is the most overvalued market ever. And then what did you do this month? Oh, we bought stocks. It's like, just a minute.
Right. Because they can't afford to have it go the other way. And they just, like, if they're underweight, they have to do it. So I do think we're close. And then the other final thing is, if you go look at the Fed's balance sheet, you know, we were talking about how they took it from $4 trillion to $7 trillion. Well, it hasn't gone up in a while. It's actually rolling over because they're letting some things expire in terms of swap lines and other things like that. And so we actually have the Fed's balance sheet no longer going up, and it's actually rolling over. And I think last week it even went down.
Yeah.
Now, so there's, from a short-term perspective, there's some things to be kind of be careful about I think we're going to get a 10% to 20% correction, and it's going to be quick and it's going to be violent and it's going to be over in 2 weeks. And then everyone's going to get really bearish, and they're going to start talking about tests to the old lows. And then what you're going to find, as long as the government do what I anticipate them doing, which is stepping up really quickly with more programs, then what'll happen is that it'll be a very, it'll be quick, but it'll be over and it'll be 20% tops.
And do you think these, the speed of movements, I think I'm certainly with you into the speed of movements are obviously, you know, we've had I think it was the fastest drop and then the fastest rise and all that type of factor. Do you think this is the robots and the, the momentum traders sort of really loading up in this? Is that what you think is driving it, or you think there's something different?
So I do think the nature of trading has changed. When I used to trade, we used to buy and sell. Like, if something was up, we'd actually sell it, and because it would often spike higher and then you get to buy it back. Nowadays, if you go look, if a stock spikes higher, most likely what's going to happen is it's going to grind higher the rest of the day. Like, how many times have we got up all of a sudden at 9:30 out of nowhere, the S&P rallies, 100 basis points. And then for the rest of the day, like, it goes, the rallies at 100 basis points literally in 10 minutes. Hmm. And then for the rest of the day, it grinds higher another 100 basis points with almost no dips in between.
Yep.
And what that is that's a huge program that's just a VWAP. He goes, they get it started right away, and then they VWAP it the rest of the day. Hmm. And so the nature
VWAP,
of trading...
Just for our listeners, VWAP is volume weighted average price. So basically just saying that
there's a lot of
trading machines out there that you say, okay, I want to buy, whatever, $1 million of stock, and I'll do it at the average price for the day. And so they'll just sit that. There's a program there that'll just sit there and drip it out and just try and match the average price for the day.
Right. And so what you get is you'll get... let's just say you have 10 million to buy and 9 million to sell. It'll be a net imbalance of 1 million. And so that million will just cause it to grind higher.
Hmm.
And so I think the nature of trading has changed, and it's no longer as much fun that way, because we get these moves that are very much just that kind of, let's just say, robotic in terms of, unnatural. But, I sit on a trading desk, and we have some young traders, and they just trade differently than us. And the old guys are forced to kind of adapt, but I see the young guys, they adapt a lot quicker. So they see a stock that's up on a stick, and whereas our instincts are always to sell it because it's gone too far too fast, their instincts are, well, the chances are if it's up on a stick, it's just going to keep going.
And so that's almost an analogy for the whole market, though. That, I guess what I'm looking at is going, yeah, there's a bit of a bounce, and then that'll fade out, though, and...
We'll wait for the
fundamentals kick in, but this one's been pushed out higher by that.
And it doesn't. Mm. And they just keep going and going. And and unfortunately, the other thing is it sends you a lot of kind of false signals, because you'll go and this VWAP means that very few people are trading. Like, the people that are moving the markets, that are making decisions, don't make midday decisions. So they're not going and looking at the market saying, I'm going to buy it. Like in the old days when I sat on the desk, we'd have a portfolio manager that would sit around waiting for a good time to come in and buy the SPY equivalent, the S&P 500, equivalent. And then they would pick that moment and they would buy a chunk.
And you'd give them a call, you'd say, oh, the market's up 1%. Do you still want to keep buying? And they might go, no, I've changed my mind. I stopped.
Right, exactly. And then they would come back in, and then they'd be buy. Nowadays, they make this decision in the morning and they go, I'm going to buy this. And they stick it in the machine and they go away. And it doesn't even matter if there's some news. And this is one of the things that you'll notice, that there'll be a bad headline, and sometimes it'll just keep chugging and you'll be like, what the heck's going on? Like, are they blind? And then the next day it'll go down and you'll be like, but wait, why didn't that news was yesterday? Why didn't you guys figure this out? And it's because there's all these guys out there that are running these VWAPs, and it's the nature of trading has changed, and you can complain about it and yell at it, or you can just kind of adapt to it. And so that's one of the things that I say is that you'll find nowadays you'll just get these moves. Like when I think about the robots as such, I think that what they've really done is made it so that you get a lot more trend days. So it trends one way and it trends that way all the time. Like, I think that a lot of this move higher initially was the bank of the Japanese Postal Service. And I had a lot of theories as why this was, but it was very much driven by the yen. And I could see the yen, it would sell off, and every other currency was going up, but the yen was selling off. And I really think it was the Japanese Postal Service made a huge, huge asset shift. And I think for 2 weeks there, they were coming in every day and they were buying S&Ps. And they were just VWAPing it in, and then they were selling, selling yen to pay for it.
And they were asleep. They're asleep while you're buying.
Yeah.
Place the order.
Exactly.
And I think wake up in the morning.
They're just doing it, right? Yeah. And I think that's why there's more of this price insensitive buyers. Mm. And I would agree with you that there's a rise in that.
Yeah.
That is something I've definitely noticed.
The other question in terms of risks, I guess I'm catching you on your two different time frames as well, sort of short-term bearish but longer-term positive, because I think that probably treats me for Biden in terms of saying, well, as you said, higher minimum wages will actually help generate that extra demand and everything like that in the longer term. But short-term, there's a bunch of tax raises coming through. And so the odds are obviously strengthening a lot on his election at the moment. Do you think the market will treat his election, or as we get as it becomes more certain, or if it happens, as a net negative in terms of the whatever it is?
Yeah, so I do think they'll treat it more net negative, and I actually worry about it, and I worry about it for the tax reason. I worry as well about him wanting to balance the budget, and you actually hear him talking about it. He's talking about not just raising taxes, but he's legitimately like old school politician that's sitting there thinking that I can't leave this to the grandchildren. And if we get that kind of budget hawk kind of attitude, you're going to find that that's what Europe tried to do.
Yes.
Europe tried to, you know, tried to fix everything by telling people, no, no, the problem is you're spending too much. So we cut back on the spending, and then lo and behold, the economy rolls over and they go, whoa, geez, the economy rolled over. Let's lower rates. And then that didn't work. And, you know, that just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worry that Biden is going to come. He's going to probably do some increased regulation, and he's probably also going to do some redistributive kind of tax policies. But what really worries me is that he's going to actually make it so that the overall amount of dollars in the economy goes down. And everyone's going to blame it on all those other policies, not realizing it's actually just that he's taking too much dollars out of the system.
Yeah.
And so I ironically think that he's really bad for the stock market. And what's going to happen is that, like, I almost wanted a younger person there that was more willing to go for it. Because I said, at least, yeah. And not like, listen, I'm a Canadian anyways. We can't affect it. And and American politics is
it's a spectacular
bewildering
sport
at the best of times. Yeah. So, but anyway, so the I do worry that the stock market will be concerned about Biden, and I am legitimately concerned about Biden as well. Not for the reasons though that most of Wall Street is. I'm worried about it because I think that he's going to fall for this idea that Republicans, they're going to trick him and say, you got to balance the budget, you got to balance the budget, and he's going to fall for it.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and so that's why I think that the stock market go down. And not only that, listen, corporate taxes, whether they should go up or not, I don't know. And it's a society's decision. But if they go up, they're going to have troubles with the stock market. Now, I think one of the things you did say to me, though, is you said more dollars in people's pockets, and you were implying that I thought that the stock market would be higher. And I do agree with that the stock market would be higher. But I kind of feel like it's actually going to, if we do get this situation with Biden in there and he doesn't withdraw stimulus from the actual kind of economy, then I think it will benefit the economy more than the stock market. And it will be Main Street over Wall Street. And I think that is one thing that will change. And that is kind of a long-term bearish argument why the bubble will stop. That if we get a situation where the real economy starts going up as opposed to the financial economy.
Yeah.
Then it will be much different.
Yeah. So it's funny though, because I've been using this term a bit. It's almost as if I'm saying, well, you know, we're suspending capitalism in a way, because you know you're not letting companies go broke. You're pumping money into the corporate debt markets. You're doing all these things. Spending and so the answer is, if we suspend capitalism, you should go out and buy stocks. But if the reverse happens, if we get capitalism again, oh mate, you got to get out of stocks. You don't want stocks in a capitalist environment.
Don't you think as well that it's going to change the nature of the stocks you should be in?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've changed quite dramatically in terms of, and there was that part of that question, I guess, we were quite, well, we loaded up in the early days. So I guess, I think last time I spoke to was on your program, and you're saying, you know, what's happening? And I said, oh, well, I'm in the brace position and I'm wondering why we haven't crashed yet. And so we loaded up at the time on, you know, the Cloroxes and the Johnson & Johnsons and all these other ones like that, that then got way overvalued. And so now we're digging around trying to find where can we find value in these ones. And one of the, it's an ironic thing that we're doing as well, is we're picking up a little bit more of that. We're sort of going, we're expecting quite negative effects in terms of people losing their jobs and economic effects and all that type of stuff. But we're buying some luxury goods because we actually think some of the guys that are quite wealthy are still going to do all right and they're still going to want to buy stuff. And so, you know, selectively, because you know, some of the, some luxury goods we think of are like souvenirs, and other ones are more sort of ongoing. So yeah, so it's those types of ones where it is very hard to put a portfolio together at the moment to try and cater for, you know, the movements we're having and saying, well, I really like that story, but geez, that stock's expensive. I've just got to try and find something else, the next best thing at a price that's at least semi reasonable.
Right. And so if you think, though, to my idea about inflation, though, if inflation comes, I think that the lot of the nature of companies that were previously high capex with the high fixed costs will all of a sudden appear much more attractive. Whereas in the past, nobody wanted those, right?
Yeah,
Everyone wanted software companies. And if you think about it, software companies benefited, like they are, you know, like those tech growth names, they are the ultimate longest asset because most of their profits are out in the future because all of it is growth into the future. Mm. So with interest rates going lower, they are the ultimate kind of stock you should own for that because they are the longest duration asset. And if you get a situation where interest rates go back up, you no longer want to be long those long duration assets and you actually wanted to find something with high fixed costs that will with some pricing power that will be able to, you know, benefit from the inflation.
Yeah. Or, and the pricing power, I think, is the most important thing. Because I do think there are some of the stocks that will maintain the pricing power. And so we'll be able to carry.
Right.
Yeah. But you're right. There's a bunch out there that are priced on. That pricing power is the key to that. And there are definitely software stocks that don't have it. Yeah.
Right. But those fixed cost walls and appear much more attractive. Like, I think someone brought up this, one of my guests the other day brought up something and he said, if you go look at amusement parks have a huge fixed cost.
Yeah.
And if we get a situation where if we have a decade of 5% inflation and, you know, the price, the kind of the ability for people to, you know, to keep up with that inflation and the rising wages. And then meanwhile, the costs are all paid for because all your rides and everything are all paid for, and that's going to stay constant. So you want to own assets that are already kind of high fixed costs that have the ability to raise prices.
Yeah.
And that was one of his ideas.
Now, yeah, that's right. And it doesn't work from a cash flow perspective, but from an earnings perspective, those things get overpriced. So their earnings looks better as well because they go, okay, I built this thing for $100 million and I'm depreciated at whatever, $5 million a year. And in 10 years' time, though, you're still depreciating that $5 million. But if you had to rebuild it, it would cost you a lot more. It might cost you $200 million at that stage. And so your actual depreciation versus your, is because it's based on such longer term. And they used to, back in the 70s, they used to have to make adjustments. People used to make adjustments to company earnings to try and account for that. and then we haven't had to worry about it because there's no inflation. So who cares? And so,
You
might have to go back to those.
The other thing, I'd like to leave you with in terms of an idea for something to own. Like if we go look at the stock market returns over the last 1, 5, and 10 years, and obviously everyone knows that the U.S. has just shot the lights out. Everyone has rushed into the U.S. assets because the U.S. dollar has been going up over the last kind of decade or at least the last 5 years. And not only that, the stock market has outperformed. The last year at this point, I can't remember, I did a rolling 1 year, it was 12.8%, 5 year was 9.85%, and 10 year was 13%, okay? Now, what a lot of people kind of don't realize is that when they go look at like the DAX, like let's just pick some crappy like index like that, it was minus 1.7% for 1 year, 0.5% for 5 year, and almost 6% for 10 year. And then when you put it into US dollar terms, it was slightly different. Okay. Now, one of the things that people kind of mistake is they always talk about Japan as being this terrible country with poor economic policy, bridges to nowhere, all sorts of high debt. Zombie companies. You know, if you look at their returns, over the last year, it was 9.3%, 5 year is 6.2%, 10 year is 8.67%, remarkably kind of quality. And then you're going to say, well, but wait, they devalued their yen. It was all the currency. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it in U.S. dollar terms, it was pretty much the same. 8.6% 1 year, 3.29% for 5 years. So you can see the period there that they did devalue. But over a 10-year return, it was 10.5%. And so when I go back to the fiscal, you know, we were talking about who's doing fiscal, you know, what their kind of responses are. The Japan's doing 20% of their GDP in terms of monetary stimulus, but they're doing 40% in terms of fiscal stimulus. They are doing more than anybody else out there. They
and,
are
and
the,
doing better
the
on
most
the virus.
Aggressive.
Doing better,
yeah,
on the virus
and doing better on the virus.
Yeah. Now that's
so
that's
I think that's
a bit of a, and the other one I have for those ones is there's we've got a number of we hold quite a number of Japanese stocks in that. I do think they have sort of they're not the same zombie companies you got 10 years ago. And we think we've got a number of companies in there that we think will benefit as companies move out of China and need to automate processes and things like that, that they're actually quite good in that. There's some companies that are quite good in that space if you can steer them away from. It's sort of like this. We're trying to find the ones in there where, because a lot of those robotic ones also have big oil and gas exposures, and so it's trying to go, well, have they fallen enough for the oil and gas exploration that's not going to happen? And then I need to get it for the rise we think in manufacturing automation that is going to happen. And so, yeah,
right.
I think there's a lot of interesting companies within that Japan.
It's kind of shocking though, because it's by far and away the best returning stock market after the U.S. Nobody's even close out of the big, like, top 10 economies. Mm. And yet it gets absolutely no respect.
Yeah. Mm. And it's often, and I do think that there's that part, the currency is often important. Certainly over shorter periods of time, you often sit there and you look and you go, oh, God, oh, look at this stock. I just made all this money. And you're like, oh, I got it all back on the currency. And then just, let me find somewhere that doesn't happen. Yeah. But that's, yes.
Very good.
Excellent. No, well, and I just want to, noting that, you know, it is very late over it there. And I want to thank you especially for staying up late to talk to us.
It's my pleasure. It's great. It's great chatting with you guys. And listen, if anyone wants to kind of find out about what I do or get a couple of examples of my letter, please just shoot me an email. It's kevin@themacrotourist.com. I'm more than happy to kind of fire some off.
Excellent. I was going to give you a chance for that, because especially because I think since we've spoken, you've launched that as a paid newsletter now, hadn't you? I think it was a freebie for everyone. Now people have realized how good value it is. Yes.
Well, it's very kind of you to say. It's been a lot of fun. And you know what? One of the nice things is that when it was free, I didn't do comments because it gets overwhelming. And then, you know, when you get free, a lot of people are there,
for the
wrong reasons and stuff like that. But when you get people that are interested in kind of participating and doing it, I've been, you know, hugely kind of, surprised and happy by the fact that the comments have been a huge part of it, and I actually learned just as much from my readers as I hopefully teach them.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're developing quite a community there, Kevin. So that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. We might just finish. We've got one. We're bringing in a question of the week, and we're obviously putting this out to our viewers as well to let us know in the YouTube comments of the video. But we might just finish up on the question to you, Kevin. So how long do you think the bubble will last? And you can just give us the high level.
With your short-term view.
With a short-term
your short-term hat on.
Yeah.
The short-term hat, like meaning that, like, so if so the if we get a correction of 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. So does that count as the bubble breaking?
Yeah, let's call that the bubble for your purposes.
Okay, so I think we're going to get a correction. We won't get new highs in the S&P before we get a correction of 10% or more.
Right.
Okay. Very good.
Like I think the highs are already in, and we're headed lower from here.
Mm. Okay. All right. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thanks very much for that. Thanks for sharing with us your time. And as Damien said, I appreciate it's very late over there, and we it's fantastic. We can chat live, both yourself and obviously out to our audience as well. So. Thanks again, and we look forward to having you on the show very soon.
My pleasure. It's been great chatting with you guys.
Lovely. All right, very good. For those listening in, of course, thanks very much for your attendance today. And please do head over to the YouTube comments, and we really will be looking forward to seeing what your thoughts are on how long the bubble will last. Maybe Damien will pop his down there as well. So we've got some views, so we can take it from there. And we hope you've enjoyed today's show. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. We always appreciate guest or topic selections, so if you've got one, drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. And finally, if you know someone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it and share it with a friend to help our podcast grow. So on that note, thanks for tuning in, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.